Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be back again and lovely to be called a friend of AIFS. I'm really delighted about that. And it was actually in 2013 that I came as part of another international symposium on child support, which we were doing in Canberra, and then we came to AIFS as well to present some of our work. And it was during that visit in 2013 that Kay and Sarah and I sat in our MIT in the coffee bar, as you do, cooking up a plan to do some more research. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. And this is the outcome of that coffee conversation at our MIT. And we're really delighted to be here today to talk about that. And in fact, it's just about to be published in the Journal of, I always get the wrong way around, Social Poverty and Social Justice. So you should be getting that to you if you're subscribing to that magazine journal. Pretty soon. They haven't given us an actual publication date, but so hopefully it won't be too long. So you get a preview first. Out of our conversation in our MIT in 2013, I was talking about work I had done and just finished on addressing this question in the UK. So we talk about child support and we see it as a private obligation, publicly, policy enforced, if you like. And the UK policy scheme originally had, well, not the very original, we've been through about three iterations of complete radical change. I won't go into the detail of that. But in the middle point of the radical change and the Labour government came along, they said we really should have child poverty as an explicit aim of this policy, because obviously it's financial support, albeit from the other parent, it's private money, as it were, and it should reduce lone mother poverty. Great, sounds good. Combine that with benefits, except at that point, the lone parents never got a penny bean of the child support. The government took all the money from the lone parents. So there was a real contradiction, one might say, in the policy aims. How can you say it's supporting poverty when it absolutely has no impact on increasing the income package of lone mothers? So policy moved on, and we had, not unlike Australia, we had radical reform in 2008. And the reform in 2008, broadly speaking, was let's all make it private. Let's put it back in the hands of parents. We've not done a very good job. If anybody wants to know about the diabolical administrative mess in the UK, please feel free to come and ask me. But it was absolutely at the point of collapse on more than one occasion. And so they brought in Sir David Henshaw, a business guru, to come and sort of physically look at it all and sort it out. And he wrote a big report and sort of more or less said, you know, this is a private obligation. It should go back in the hands of parents and the state should step back. So we will not make it compulsory for lone parents who are in receipt of Social Security benefits to notify the agency about the details of the father so the agency can pursue the father for child maintenance. We call it child maintenance, child support, same thing. So that was the kind of framing in 2008, private-based arrangements. And the government, UK government was very worried, though, because remember that before that, they kept all the child maintenance money that was paid. They didn't give any of it to the lone parent. So they were very worried, if we're going to give this child maintenance now to lone parents and they're on benefits, does that mean they're going to languish on benefits and have a life of luxury? I'm sure this is a rhetoric you might be familiar with in Australia. So sponging off the state, scrounging off the state, all this pejorative kind of language. So we're very worried about introducing work disincentives for lone parents. So we give them the money they're entitled to. They might not go to work. So they did a big study on that, and they decided they would do it in incremental stages. So the first thing they did after the 2008 Act came in, they said, OK, you can keep the first £20 of child maintenance. Of course, you can keep it if it's paid. If it's not paid, you don't get anything. So we didn't really know what the poverty effect was going to be of the policy because, as I said, they never got any money anyway. So the poverty rates of low-income parents was directly related to the value of the social security system. So in the UK, we did this study, first of all, so, well, let's look at this £20 disregard, they called it, and see if that has, if that amount of child maintenance for those that get it has an impact on poverty. So that's the kind of starting point for this. I'm going to begin this talk informing you about the kind of UK, I'm sorry, this is very sensitive, I'll try, no, here we go. So I'm going to set out some of the context, which I think I've probably done. We're going to talk about UK evidence this £20 disregard and the effect on child poverty. And then I'm going to hand over to Kay, who's going to talk about the Australian evidence. And this is the work that the three of us did together. So you're kind of getting two studies in one. The UK study that I did will report first, and then the joint study we did on Australia. And Kay will fill you in about that. And we'll kind of end with a comparison about the data from the two studies, see if they can tell us anything. They weren't meant to be directly comparable, but it's still nice to kind of look and see what the results are and what it might mean. So I'm happy to take questions as we go along. If anybody wants to interrupt, that's absolutely fine. So I'll move on to the UK study. I'm going to set the context on lone parenthood first. And this is just, you know, all of this is just to kind of warm ourselves up, thinking about this context. So we see a growth in lone parent families. Of course, it's not just common to Australia and UK. It's common across all the developed and increasingly developing worlds. And the OECD average of children in 2010 is 16% of children. You see Australia's hovering around the OECD average, but the UK is much higher, and we can see a representation of that. Gives you some idea of the number of lone parent families or the percentage of children living in lone parent families across all these countries. Of course, the USA is a big outlier on the left there, and Australia, as I say, hovering around the OECD average. What the darker blue is those with no parents. So we see a continuing growth, though, in non-married... See, I'm not touching it, and it's moving on itself. Proportional births... Where am I? Yeah, so non-marital births, they continue to grow, too. And this is analysis done by the OECD in their publication, Doing Better for Families. And we can see that was at that time 28 countries. And we can see the average for the OECD in 1980 was 11%. Australia and UK are roughly hovering around the OECD average. But then the UK shoots off by 2007. It's at 43%. Of births outside marriage, with Australia at 32%. Again, still hovering around the OECD average there. And we can see that here. Again, representing this change is the yellow bars from 1980 to 2007. So quite a mixed picture, really. You can see Iceland had a huge proportion, even in 1980. And their births outside marriage is really very high indeed, 65% or so. The thing is, this figure, of course, just tells you about births outside marriage. A lot of these relationships, the parents will go on to marry. And, of course, some of them are in marital-style cohabiting relationships. So these are not, obviously, lone parent data, but it gives you an idea of what's happening there. And so what's the future going to look like? Well, some countries have done projections about where is the future, what's the future going to look like? And in the Doing Better for Families, we can see this future projection, 2025, see, I'm not touching it, 2025 to 2030. And Australia is predicting a further growth of 25% at that time, and similarly in the UK at 22%. Germany is predicting a drop in their predicted number of lone parent family households. Don't ask me to explain what that means, but you can go and have a look at the Doing Better for Families. So the point there is, things are only going to increase. The number of lone parent families are going to increase in the future. It's not a trend that's going to flatten off or necessarily decline, apart from obviously in Germany. Maybe they're going to take away benefits or something. So that just kind of gives you an idea. But the key point about looking at lone parent families and the trends in lone parent families, and you know all this already, I'm sure, is they're particularly likely to have incomes below poverty thresholds. And that's not unique to Australia or the UK. And there, I didn't touch it, but it timed itself really well there. And here we have a representation of the poverty rates for all families with children in yellow, and the single parent families in blue. And this is a 50% poverty threshold of equivalent median income. And you can see immediately from that graph the disadvantaged position that lone parents are in across nearly all countries. In Australia, there's a 30% difference nearly between all families and lone parent families. Japan has some really weird, extreme variations. That's the highest one, but I think there's very few lone parents in Japan. And Britain is not looking quite as bad as Australia, and certainly not as bad as the US at the very end there. So, not looking good for lone parent families. We know that. Doesn't look like it's going to get much better in the future. And here we have this kind of interest in their economic vulnerability. And this comes at a time, too, when there's a reluctance to provide public support. We have the recession and the impact on that. In the UK, we've had very, very strict austerity measures in our social security system with rather large penalties for lone parents. Kelly came over to York in the summer, over to the UK. See, I'm still not touching. It came over to the UK in the summer, and she was talking to us all, and she met the DWP. I'm sure she's maybe disseminated that to you. And so there is this still very strong reluctance by the state to really see them as a deserving people, a bunch of people for state support. The state will encourage employment. That's the root out of poverty for them. And so the whole mantra is around making work pay. To make work pay on a low-wage economy, which the UK is, you have to make sure the benefits are even more restrictive. So it is not a life of luxury, despite what the politicians say, living on benefits in the UK. And so we need to understand more about other sources of income that lone parents can get. Were you wanting to ask a question? No, it's okay. So here we go to the question, are child support payments actually helping to reduce lone parent poverty? A question that's relevant to the UK and also to Australia. So I'll just tell you about the UK analysis that we did. And this started to set the kind of framework for the Australian analysis, which is broadly following the same approach. So we were wanting to use national data sets, and in the UK, the data set we used is, I think I come on to that to the next one, yeah. I'll come back to the data set in a minute, but we take two broad approaches to the analysis. We wanted to look at child support contributions to income, but split it up across the quintile income groups. It was quite a fine-grained analysis to see how much child support is actually being paid. Also, what is the contribution? Sometimes it doesn't give you that much information to know what median amount of child support is, but you know, how valuable is it to the income package of lone mothers? So we want to look at that as a percentage of income. And then the big question, does it make a difference? Does it lift? If you get it, does it help lift you out of poverty? And what's the kind of quantified number or proportion of low mothers that are affected in that way. It's a very simple analysis, but actually it's quite mind-blowing because you're using all sorts of different income groups. So the quintile income groups and poverty groups had to be constructed, obviously, before you included child support income. So it's quite a kind of calculation of taking the income variables and then subtracting child support and then putting it all back in again. Anyway, the detail of that we can talk about if you want. And the poverty threshold we used is the OECD standard here at 60% of contemporary equivalised median income. There's a whole big debate and argument about whether that really is a good poverty threshold or not. And increasingly, governments are wanting to use the 50% poverty threshold because, of course, you then have less people in poverty, but perhaps in more severe poverty. It's probably good to use two. But that was this study was done before all the contemporary debate around the poverty threshold took place in Britain, in which we now have a child poverty strategy stroke commitment to measure child poverty. The government are obligated, have a legal duty to do so. MD wants to hear any more about that. I'm happy to talk about it afterwards. But anyway, we use the 60% median income. So the data source in the UK, remember this is me picking up a policy framing, change in policy in 2008 where they have a £20, allowed to keep £20 of the money, and we looked at the Families and Children study. And this is a nationally representative sample of families with dependent children. It doesn't exist anymore. It stopped after this time. This was the last wave. And what we did was we targeted and created a sample of non-widowed lone mothers, and we took the fathers out of the sample so that we just had that and those that were eligible for child support. And we ended up in the Families and Children's Study data set with 1,561 cases. And we've based our analysis on unweighted data. So I'm going to move on to the results. So for the UK at that time, and actually since the beginning of the Child Support Act in 1991, implemented in 1993, we haven't moved very far. We've hovered around a third of lone parents receiving child support. That's irrespective of which policy has been in place and all the tweaking that has gone on in between. And we have a mean amount at that time, and I've done a contemporaneous amount for Australian dollars of £63 or $134 and a median amount of about £46. So small proportion getting it, not getting a huge amount. And here we see the quintile groups. And you can see there's a pretty standard amount across the lowest quintile up to the highest quintile. But still in all, you see a U-shaped kind of graph here in which it's the poorest in the quintile and the richest that are getting the same median amounts higher than the middle income groups. We used the median just to kind of take out the outliers that were going to overinflate. You know, you do a few extreme outliers there, so the median is a better kind of thing. So we kind of came to the conclusion this was a kind of going rate for child maintenance. Remember, this is not the Child Support Agency clients. This is a data set of the population of families with dependent children. And then when we further broke the sample down into different groupings, into poverty groups, we have three poverty groups, the 60% median. Below that is those are all in poverty. Then we had a middle group, 60% of median, up to the median, the population median, and then above the median. And you can see here, actually, it's the richest parents in the UK that get the most. So the richest lone parents are getting more money than the poorest lone parents in child support income. And then we think of how much it is worth in terms of a percentage of income. Although the richest parents are getting more in real terms on average, you can see it makes up much less of their income package, just about 8 to 9%, whereas for the poor, those in poverty, is between 14 and 20%. These are before housing cost and after housing cost measures. So as you would expect, it makes up more of your income after you've paid for housing cost. But it doesn't seem to make much difference for the richer group at the top. So how many have actually been lifted out of poverty? So we've done a kind of two ways table, and this is just done on those that have received child support. And in total, 74 parents have been moved out of poverty. So the below 60% medium group here. And so they 70 move into the higher income group out of poverty, and then another four move from poverty into the above median group. Overall, that represents about 14% reduction in poverty. So child maintenance has, for those who receive it, that ability to reduce poverty in that population of lone mothers by about 14%. So not huge, but still very valuable. So thank you. I'm going to hand over now to Kay, yeah, who's going to give you a story about the Australian data.
So we essentially used the same methods that Christine used in her UK analysis and then applied these to the HILDA data set using 2011 data. And Sarah did the analysis, so if you have any questions about that, you could direct it to her. And I will talk about the broad trends of narrative things and things like that. So we constructed our sample in the same way, where we selected lone mothers not living with a partner, with a child under 18, had a non-resident parent and was eligible to receive child support. And from the HILDA study, we had 396 such lone mothers. And again, we excluded lone fathers because they're a significantly different cohort to lone mothers. So we wanted to focus in on lone mother poverty, just like they did in the UK. And we also used unweighted data in our analysis. And so the median Australian population equivalized household income at 2011-12 was $770 per week. And then if we apply the poverty threshold to that of the same 60% median, the poverty line was estimated to be at $462 per week. So they're the figures we're relying on when we construct our below median and above poverty line thresholds. So in Australia, based on the HILDA sample, just over half of the mothers that were eligible to receive child support reported receiving any child support payments in the previous year. So this is whether in the last 12 months you might have received one payment, you might receive exactly what you're entitled to every week. There's no way of differentiating that using the HILDA data source. It's just, did you receive any in the previous year, yes or no? So 57% of mothers reported receiving some child support. The mean amount of that, as you can see, was $132, and the median weekly amount was $90. So of these, the HILDA data set's quite interesting in the way that child support is asked in that survey. So not all of the mothers that received child support were asked about the way that their child support agreement was determined. So there were 227 mothers in receipt of child support, and of these, 207 of them were asked about the agreement type. We're not sure why those other 20 weren't asked. It's just one of the vagaries of the HILDA data set. But of those 207 that were asked about how their child support was agreed upon, 85% of these were going through the child support agency formula, and it was the CSA agreement. So if we look at ours divided up in the quintile groups, and we did the same analysis using the quintile groups, pre-child support income, we can see here that the median amounts of child support, unlike the UK, it was the lowest income quintile group that received by far the most child support per week, the median amount. And the second lowest quintile was receiving the lowest amount of child support per week. So this was really starkly different. We didn't see the U-shaped pattern, And likely this is due in part to the income shares approach in Australia, where both parents' income is taken into consideration. So at the higher end of the quintiles, the resident parents' income also contributes to that formula and will reduce the amount expected. But if we look at these, the two lowest quintile groups, both of these groups are below the poverty threshold when we move to the next slide. So there's a markedly different amount of child support being received, even though both of these families have very low incomes. So if we move to these poverty groups, you can see that 175 of the 227 parents that were receiving child support had incomes below the poverty line pre-child support. And the 151 had incomes between that poverty line of $462 a week and the national median that was 770. And then another 70 parents had incomes above the median. And if we look at the expected amount of child support, or the amount received, sorry, again, we see those in the lowest groups, the poorest lone mothers, receive the highest amount of child support. So again, it's likely that income shares model that's reducing the amount of child support being received at the higher ends of the spectrum. So it's largely consistent with the results from the quintile analysis, but the quintile analysis gives us a much finer grained analysis that Christine was saying, that when we look at this below poverty group, we think, oh, that's great, but there's very marked differences between the very poorest and those that are just below the poverty line in terms of how much child support they're receiving and the extent to which that can then lift them out of poverty. So again, it raises important questions about what is child support actually contributing to the household incomes of lone parent families. And so if we look at those in poverty, child support's contributing approximately 28% of their household income before housing costs and 41% after housing costs are taken into consideration. And just like the UK, the differences between before and after housing costs and the contribution that child support makes are much smaller at the higher end of the spectrum. But for those in the below poverty group, child support is really providing a significant proportion of their income. And you will note also that my slides are not skipping ahead. Just to point that out too.
Even though you're not touching.
Yeah, not touching. So we did a much simpler version of Christine's scale. So we don't have the fine detail of how many moved from, say, below poverty into the above median group. But we can see those that are moving. We started off with, let me make sure I get this right. For those mothers that were receiving payments, or only looking at those 227 mothers that actually received child support payments, the child support reduced the incidence of poverty by 21%. So we look at those below poverty before child support payments, it was 52%. And then if we look at those in poverty, so this row, after we add child support back in, that's reduced to 31%. So 21% of those previously impoverished lone parent families have moved down the rows and are either in the below median, above poverty, or above median groups. So what do we make of all of this? That child support in Australia, and it's because we don't have this $20 maximum, which has since been done away with in the UK, and single parents can keep all of the child support that is received now, the kicker of which is that it's entirely privatised and the access to something like the child support agency has been made more difficult, that it's fee for entry and then fee for service model, which hopefully we don't move to here, but you never know. So in Australia, those that were... We had sort of higher rates of receipt of child support, and we also had those that ours at the lower end of the spectrum received much more child support than those did in the UK, where it was those the richest parents were most likely to receive and receive more, I think. We also had the lowest income quintile groups producing that U-shaped curve in the UK, whereas in Australia ours was much more, I'll do it this way for you, the lower income ones were receiving more and the higher income ones were receiving less. while we have relatively high rates of receipt in Australia compared to the UK, ours are reducing poverty by much more in Australia than they were in the UK. It was 14% in the UK, whereas 21% in Australia. So we need to, what this means in terms of where this leads us, Australia and the UK, these data were collected at different times where we've had different policy arrangements. The UK has since moved on, but the broad trends are that in Australia, child support is making a significant difference to the poverty rates of lone parents, yet reducing poverty is not one of the aims of the child support system in Australia. It was originally, that has since drifted away. Whereas in the UK, they have these statutory mechanisms to look at reducing poverty, and now child support payments.